Shoot the Defence, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. It's my top five matches. I'm your host, Stel. And my guest is a good friend. He's a very good friend. We've known each other for quite a few years. He's been on the podcast before. I've been on his Low Limit Football. He's my Paraguayan prince friend, as I like to call him. Roberto Rojas. How you doing, my friend?
How are you, Stel? I'm doing well, man. I don't know what to deal with this hair, though, because for
Shave
some
it
reason...
Off.
You know something? I'm seeing tweets from people. I don't know if this is an English thing or something, but everyone that's getting a haircut is, I mean, maybe it's just here in America or something. It's like if people get a haircut, they're just like doing like a small one. But over there in England, they're like shaving it off completely. And I'm thinking to myself, one of these days I'm going to do it, but just it doesn't look good, man. Listen, you know very well, Stel, I still look like a baby, even though I'm 22 years old. I tried growing a beard, and let me tell you, it's like when you're still getting confused for being younger than who you are when you have a beard or at least some sort of stubble, then you know something is not right, and you're just going to stay like that forever. But the hair thing kind of has to go. So, yeah, above anything else besides that, yeah, I'm doing well, man.
Good.
I can't wait to do this. This is really interesting.
Excellent. Well, before we continue, first of all, I need to ask you something based on what you just said about the age thing. Is it true, because this is what I've been told, I'm not going to mention any names, is it true that when you go to a restaurant, they give you a kid's menu?
Yes. Not all restaurants, but a lot of them. That is correct. They don't do that in England?
Man. Come on. You're not being serious. I know.
No, I'm being 100% honest.
Shut up. I was only joking. I haven't spoken to anyone, but I just... Yeah, okay. Fair enough. See? Ropes you right in there, mate. Ropes you right in there.
Yeah, there you go.
But
yep.
There you go. No, listen. It's a testing time for everyone. A relative of mine passed away this morning. It wasn't due to COVID. It's a tricky one to kind of fathom, because speaking to my relatives in Cyprus who obviously were close to this person, they're saying, you know, that she was in an old people's home and they didn't really get to spend much time with her and whatnot because of COVID-19. And you know, it's very sad. A lot of people aren't able to see family, friends. As you know, I've got a daughter, she hasn't seen her school friends. Okay, they do Zoom conferences every week, but it's not the same thing. And then when they go back to school, it's not going to be the same as what it was before. I don't know how us in the UK are going to get over this. You guys obviously are in a much, much bigger country. And you have it worse because you've got people protesting out there now, haven't you?
Yeah, we do. And that's in all parts of the country. I think the biggest, and of course, you know, we don't want to get too political, but the people that are running the country aren't exactly doing their job as well, or at least extending to the matters that they should. And yeah, that just creates a lot of problems. And yeah, it's been like this for quite some time. And you know, unfortunately, I'm sure you see the news that happen every so often. And you know, Florida man does this or something in New York or something. It will definitely be a new world when this eventually ends. And I think for myself as well, I think it's the time to always just take care and of yourself and always reach out to family. You know, I'm always in contact with my parents. You know, my dad's in Paraguay right now. He can't leave and go back to the States. But, you know, I'm always in contact with him every day, hoping that he's all right. Even if it's like a little WhatsApp note of like 20 seconds, like, hey, what's up, dad? How are you? And it's just like, nothing well, how are you? And I just say, yeah, I'm cool, man. And just, that's it. Even if it takes like 30 seconds, as long as he's doing fine and he's healthy, and of course my other direct family as well, then I am most content about this.
No, absolutely, mate. And do you know what? Sorry to stay on the whole political trail here, but I think it goes to show how incompetent both of our regimes are, really. I mean, listen, I don't mean to take the piss or anything, but Greece, I give this as an example. It's, okay, COVID hasn't completely gone out there, but the moment they got the first cases, they're like, right, we're locking everything down. No one's going to be able to leave their homes. If you have to leave your home, you need to send a text or an SMS to this specific number to get authorization. And if you get the authorization, then you can go to the shops to get your groceries or whatever you need to get. But and that's it. And slowly, slowly, they're getting back to normal. Then you look at the UK, we've got the highest death rate in Europe. A lot of death certificates have pneumonia on instead of COVID-19, which isn't a surprise. So and I'm sure you guys have got the same problem, if not worse. So again, back to what I said before, they're bloody incompetent. I haven't got a fucking clue what they're doing, do they?
Yeah, and actually, it's funny that you mentioned other countries. And in Paraguay, you know, they kind of went through a similar approach to what Greece did, you know, after the first few cases. Because let's be fair, you know, I don't want to bash on Paraguay's health system, but, you know, it isn't like the UK and it isn't like the United States or most of the developing world. But they knew the risk. And, you know, immediately after the first few cases happened, they shut it down. They shut it down everything, you know, as if you had to leave at a certain time, you have to have some sort of approval, or unless you face a fine or even jail time, if it's even worse. And, you know, in case and here, I think we have like over there, it's like 700 cases or so, which is very low if you compare it to their neighbors of Brazil, Argentina, yeah, Peru, Chile, and all those other countries. I think it's like 10 deaths, and that number of deaths has been maintained for a couple weeks now. I mean, cases are growing, which kind of makes sense because now they're going in through this route of a smart quarantine where businesses are starting to go back to normal life. But no, in fairness, they've been able to do well, and I think you have to give that credit to those that are working in the health, in the Ministry of Health, and obviously working in the government, and, you know, having that kind of support, where unfortunately here and definitely in the UK, we don't see that kind of unity when it comes to dealing with a serious situation like this.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, let's talk about another serious situation, and that's football, my friend. Your top five matches. You've just recorded a pod with Tim Vickery based on Paraguay and their World Cup campaigns, and this one is going to be no different, I guess. Three of your matches are from the 2010 World Cup, and we'll begin with Italy 1, Paraguay 1. Italy, the reigning champions, went a goal behind through Alcaraz's header. Alcaraz, I think, was at Wigan, if I remember
correctly. And he played at Everton, yep.
Wigan at Everton, there you go. Then your goalkeeper, Villar, decided to do what he did, and De Rossi equalised for Italy. So, my friend, why was this in your top five?
Well, I think this game was important. I had just finished doing a pod with Tim Vickery and Adam Brandom at World Football Index talking about that, as you'd mentioned. For me, on a personal level, I think being, as you know, many people know, I'm Paraguayan-American. Both my parents are Paraguayan. They came to the country back in the 90s, and, you know, kind of in a time where, you know, Paraguay didn't succeed on the world stage. They hadn't made it to a World Cup since 86. And then when they first go back to the World Cup in France in 98, they do it on four straight occasions. And they kind of interesting matter, because for a team from South America that don't have the resources necessary, you know, in comparison to other nations around the world that have made it to straight World Cups and have had the caliber to do so, for a team like Paraguay to do that, I think, was demonstrated of how important they were. So on a personal level, I think this game really gives me a lot of a pride, because, you know, you think about my first World Cup was 2006. That was the first World Cup that I watched. You know, I was 8 years old at the time, and, you know, I didn't watch the entire tournament, but I did obviously watch the Paraguay games where they, you know, they played England, Sweden, and Trinidad and Tobago. They got knocked out, but, you know, I obviously saw the other games that happened, you know, the around 16s, your quarterfinals, and of course the final. And, you know, when I saw, and that final obviously gets, you know, it was important because it was Italy playing against France, you know, they won on penalties. And then when this qualifying process happens for Paraguay, when they make it to their greatest World Cup process and eventually their greatest World Cup, you know, and I'm at the right age as well. I'm 12 years old, you know, it's the summer, school's out, you know, you're thinking to yourself, yeah, this, if it goes well, then this World Cup will be special. So the game against Italy, I think, was important. One, because you know you're facing the world champions. I mean, what kind of better way to start a World Cup or at least make a good impression than taking on the reigning champions and the players that were on that team? Your Gigi Buffon, Cannavaro, De Rossi, you know, Gilardino, all those type of players that had won the World Cup 4 years ago, and to see them play against the players that you had seen, at least growing up in the last few years in the qualifying process, your Santa Cruz's, your Cardoso's, your Christian Rivero's, your Nelson Valdez, all those players, to see that was remarkable. And you know, the good memories from that is, you know, when they first take the lead from that free kick, kind of a traditional standard of Paraguayan football, you know, scoring from set pieces, that's kind of always been the style that they've had, that has kind of gave them that identity as a team that, you know, wasn't as flashy as many South American teams like Colombia or an Argentina or Brazil, but, you know, were very conservative in the way that they play football, you know, always on the defensive standpoints and playing on the counter. And this was no different. I mean, they were very consciously defending properly, being able to stop the likes of a Gilardino or Simone Pepe or Di Natale eventually afterwards. You know, it showed that, you know, they're here to compete. And, you know, when this draw happened a couple months beforehand, you know, they got into the likes with Slovakia and New Zealand. And I was just thinking to myself, we know what we're going to get with Italy. They are the reigning champions. You would think they're going to get out of the group and go very far. So I was thinking, okay, if they can get the wins against Slovakia and New Zealand and hopefully a respectable result against Italy, I wasn't going to be very sad if they lost, because I knew that they would have more opportunities. And then when they took the lead, I'm thinking, okay, why not? Let's see what we can do here. And obviously the Rossi header kind of diminished that. But I think for that World Cup, it was the first World Cup game that I remember watching it with a big enthusiastic feeling for it. I mean, again, I saw 2006, I saw the game. Maybe I wasn't too focused on it a lot and just like watched it to watch it. But for this game, it was at the right time. I knew the players that were on the pitch. I had that kind of understanding. And for me, that's why that game was very special in my heart.
Well, 2006, you were 8 years old, weren't you?
Yeah, I was 8 years old. So, and there's a shift, and let me tell you, there's a shift in life when you go from 8 to 12. Not in World Cup perspectives, but
no, I agree, mate. I agree. I'll tell you, you know, the shows I've done in the past, especially the top five matches, we've spoken about Italia 90 because that was the first World Cup I remember. And even though I do remember bits of Mexico 86, it's not as clear as Italia 90. If I watched a review of Italia 90, or every time I watch a review of Italia 90, I can tell you where I was watching these games most of the time. Whereas with 86, no chance. So I guess it's the same with you.
You know what's funny as well? And it's kind of weird as well. You know, both those worlds, I don't know what your perception of 2010 was, but from a general consensus, they're technically viewed as poor World Cups. But for me, and I'm sure for you as well, you remember it deeply because you're at the right age of being able to appreciate all the players. And yeah, I agree. I think with 2010, that whole World Cup, I remember it. You know, the whole when Spain lost to the Switzerland, you know, then obviously going and winning the final, the reemergence of Uruguay, you know, Argentina under Maradona. I mean, the United States, of course, getting that dramatic win against Algeria, which also was kind of a cool World Cup to experience because you had both your countries participating in it, the one where your family's from and kind of helped you get into the sport. And then the United States, who, for me, on a personal level, I will always respect the United States. I think what they do is great, and or at least at the time it was great, and you know I would follow them, and of course I want them to do well. Having that World Cup with those two teams, having both your teams perform extently well, or at least, you know, both of them obviously would win their group and advance to the round of 16, you know, to have that kind of experience is why, and of course many other things, I think shows the special place that South Africa has in my heart and that entire World Cup does.
Understandably so, mate. Great stuff. Okay, so move on to our next game. Slovakia 0, Paraguay 2. Now, I know where I was on that day. I was in Ibiza for a stag do. I don't remember too much about this game, to be fair, mate. But for reasons. Can I say I was under the influence of many things? The only thing I remember about that day was Brazil beating Ivory Coast. And again, everything was a blur. So please refresh my memory for this one.
Yeah, no, trust me. Listen, this game was a special one because this was technically the first. I mean, yes, Paraguay did beat Trinidad and Tobago, but I didn't even see the majority of the game. I wouldn't find out. And we were out of the World Cup anyway, so it was like, okay, whatever. Just game is a game.
Yeah.
But this one was special because, you know, it was Father's Day. It was Father's Day here in the United States. And I usually when big, at least when I remember, you know, usually when big Paraguay games happen, I'm always there with my father watching it on TV. It doesn't matter. And it was always a tradition I had done ever since I guess started watching the sport, be it World Cups, Copa Americas, qualifiers, even the Olympics when they made it all the way to the final. I mean, that it was always a tradition to always be there with my father. Maybe he would invite a few friends or so, or do like some sort of cookout for a game, you know, the asado, as I'm sure you know. So that game was really special, and you know, for him, you know, to see, I guess, his son, you know, obviously appreciative of the sport, and that game as well was important because, you know, it was entertaining. You know, Paraguay were on the attack. Martino was someone that was trying to get the best out of a team that historically was good defensively, but were not able to produce it from an attacking point of view. Obviously, that would change when he would come in for that qualifying process, and they would have their best World Cup qualifying process and scoring a lot of goals and beating every South American team in that process at least once. So that game, I guess, demonstrated the personification of what Paraguay was able to do in attack. I mean, you know, it's kind of ironic that both the goals scored by Enrique Vera and Christian Riveros, both of them were midfielders at the time. You know, it really was a fantastic moment because you get to see your country win a game. You know, it's a special occasion as well. You know, even though really Father's Day is not a big day in general around the world, I think for me it's important to kind of bond with your father, the one, or at least the one that helped you get into the sports, and you know, to have that kind of perfect day. It was an early day as well. I think it was like 8 or 9:30 in the morning. So you know, wake up and it's funny too. Actually, my dad, he would. It doesn't even, because it was a funny story. He actually woke up early for that game anyway because he wanted to see. I think there was a game before that. He had breakfast early, and he was up at like 6 in the morning, something like that. This game was at 8 or 9, and he already had his, you know, his juice, his coffee. And then I go up, and he wakes me up. He's like, "Hey, Roberto, you know, the game's about to start." And it's like 30 minutes before the game. And he's right there, and he has already a beer right there on his table at 9:30 in the morning. I didn't know at the time because, you know, it's him. You don't really notice it. But when you look at it back, I'm like, man, dude, you're starting to drink already. And then eventually he would tell me that, no, I woke up early so I could, because, you know, this game was so early that, you know, it's tradition to drink and to eat as well. So why not just take the appreciative moment? And it's also Father's Day, so he could do whatever he wants as well. And I think in terms of the emotional standpoint, when it comes to a family member that helped you, gets you into that sport, I think this game serves as a good memory, and you know, it checked off everything. You know, Father's Day, win for Paraguay, and you know, eventually they were off to the round of 16. You know, that it got them to qualification, which was the most important thing.
What do you remember of Vera's goal?
Well, it was an interesting goal because I remember him just you know, he got the ball from the midfield, and you know, he would get and he would shoot, but I just remember both of them. I remember him falling at one point, and I didn't see when the goal happened. And then obviously I saw when the goal happened. And, you know, you don't remember, you recall it. It's like, oh, cool, they scored. And, you know, obviously with, you know, the whole bonding thing, like, oh, celebrating with your dad and stuff like that. You know, we would always, you know, have the, it's always been a tradition as well that we would put the Paraguayan flag in front of the house during a World Cup. And yeah, I think that, and then when the second goal happened, I guess, you know, and I was into the whole analytical side of things. Like, okay, if Paraguay win this game, and they're in the round of 16. And then when Italy tied New Zealand that same day, I was thinking to myself, okay, it could happen. And, you know, we've had one more game against New Zealand, which I don't have any memories of that game. Even though I guess it recalls it, because it's weird. I had already known we were in the World Cup. We were in the round of 16. So at this point, I was like, okay, whatever. Let's see what happens. My dad and I'm just like, I'm chilling. I'm seeing, because we had we're watching in the living room, but I have a TV in my room as well. When I want to watch the games, maybe a game that I don't want to watch because there's like it's too hot, and you know my room has an AC and that. So I'm watching this game somewhat, and just like I didn't care what happened. I was like, we're in the round of 16. Who cares? And then I just see my dad. He's just like stressful. You know the whole thing when you're like an older person just watching the game. He's like, his hands are crossed. He has his like his hands on his. On his throat,
yeah,
like a generic kind of stress. I'm sure he was stressed, despite the fact that we were in. But you know, he didn't matter. So, yeah, I think that group stage was a good memory. You know, like a good summer as well, and obviously would play in part to the game against that we're going to talk about as well in the round of 16.
All right, let's go with it. Paraguay 0, Japan 0. This game wasn't as entertaining as the other games for Paraguay, but at the end, penalty shootouts, and yeah, your goalkeeper was a hero in this one.
Yeah, he was. He definitely was. I think this was an important game. You know, I always want to go back to my father because, you know, he had seen Paraguay make it to the round of 16 on three occasions, 86, 98, and 2002. Both of them where they obviously lost on all occasions to Europeans. You know, the game against France, They would lose it on a golden goal by Laurent Blanc, the first ever golden goal, actually.
That's right.
It's a unique game in a way because it demonstrated the defensive fortitude that they had. You know, Chilavert was the emblematic player that he was and was important, and obviously he couldn't do everything, and that's why they would score in the last few seconds. But that game is still memorable and kind of. even going back, even thinking about it back then, it's just like it was memorable because it showed that it pushed France all the way. And you know, even I remember watching an interview a few days ago where the great Lilian Thuram, obviously a great defender and from France and played in Italy, you know, he says that game, of all the games that they played in that World Cup, and you know, they played Italy, they played Croatia, they played Brazil in the final, you know, he said that game against Paraguay over there in the round of 16 was the hardest one ever, I mean, of that entire campaign. So it was kind of that respect. And then 2002 happened, you know, they would lose to Germany in the last minute as well. So for this game, it was important because there was a lot of history realming on about it. You know, the whole thing of like, okay, can we actually make it to the quarterfinals for the first time? And there was a lot of pressure going on, you know. Well, my dad was just—he was stressed out, and I was too as well. I mean, obviously, I didn't want—I wanted the team to go very far. I wanted the team to maybe aspire to win the World Cup, but I wanted them to go very far and put off a good demonstration. But you know, it wasn't a great game, an entertaining game like it was in maybe '98 or 2002. But it demonstrated kind of the virtues that made Paraguay so formidable to anyone on the world stage. You know, that whole reliance on defense, you know, the likes of Da Silva, Alcaraz, Bonet, Morel, Villar in goal. You know, it was demonstrated, and you know, they pushed it all the way into that penalty shootout. And you know how it is for some penalties. I'm sure in England it's a different thing. You know, the whole mentality when it comes to penalty shootouts. When it came. For this penalty shootout, I felt confident. I just, for some reason, I just felt, I mean, nowadays I'm just, you know, you're stressed about like what's going to happen. But, you know, for this one, I just felt confident because I knew this team would do something. Maybe it was just the youth understanding of myself that, oh, this team can beat anyone in that kind of sense. So, the 5-3 win on penalties, Camano hits the bar on his third penalty, and then Oscar Cardozo slots in that left-footed shot, and yeah, that was the first time I saw my dad actually cry tears of joy. And I would, and, you know, fathers are supposed, or at least South American fathers, are supposed to be tough and demonstrated their fortitude and always be very understanding. But when he had that emotion, I'm thinking to myself, and now I understand why it was so special, because he had grown up seeing the team that unfortunately was never able to make it to a quarterfinals. And it happened. It eventually happened. Obviously, I didn't mention the game against Spain in my top five, but that game against Spain, I think, was memorable as well because, you know, many of the Spanish players have also said that that was their toughest game winning when they came to that whole campaign of winning the World Cup and the 2 Euros. And obviously it kind of is bittersweet because the same man that would score the penalty to send Paraguay to their first quarterfinals would be the so-called villain because he missed the penalty against Iker Casillas that probably would have gave them the win in normal time. And then obviously David Villa scores and yeah, and that ended there. And it was really sad to see because, you know, the United States were also eliminated and then, you know, everything was relying on Paraguay. And to see that, it proves that that World Cup is special because it showed of how a team that was very, you know, formidable, maybe not as well known or flashy as we would see in future South American teams, but, you know, in terms of resistance and being able to never give up, kind of that warrior aspect of them that they have been known for, I think showed the respect. And of course, when you're a team that makes it to 4 World Cups and you have your best performance ever, you know, you have to tip your hat off. And, you know, this team, these players in general will always have a respect for me. You know, fans or journalists will have respect for teams that, you know, win titles or maybe make it to a final. But, you know, even for the quarterfinal side, even for maybe the Colombia side that made it to the 2014 quarterfinals, only losing to Brazil, that they will always have a big respect for that team. And for me, you know, watching I was and thankfully blessed to have been able to see the best World Cup performance at 12 years old than my dad would see it when he was in his late 40s. I think it just showed that, yeah, this was a sport that I really enjoyed and, you know, I wanted more of it and it would eventually lead to kind of the career that I would have a decade later. So, yeah, this was kind of the genesis of it all. And probably if it wasn't for that game or this World Cup, maybe I wouldn't be speaking to you, man. about it.
So are we saying that your dad had more influence in you following football than Tata Martino?
I mean, yeah.
Of course. Listen, the most people I know got into football because of their dads. It's that simple. It's passed on from generation to generation. My dad wasn't a massive football fan, but he followed Manchester United because of the Munich air disaster, because he was around when it happened and he remembers it. So, yeah, it's passed down from generation to generation. And being a parent myself, I'd love my daughter to get into football, but right now she's more into LOL dolls and colouring in and whatnot. So
how old is she?
She's 6, mate. She's 6.
So at that same age, I wasn't involved anyway as well. So I completely understand. So,
well, I've taken her to women's football matches, and she watches some matches with me. And she knows who Paul Pogba is. Apparently, he's my friend. I don't know.
He is your friend, though. Well, you met him, so that means you're automatically.
Yeah. Well, she's seen a couple of photographs. She's like, "Oh, it's Pogba." And she sees him on the television. She's like, "Daddy, is Pogba in London?" I'm like, "No, he's in Manchester." She goes, "Oh, is he gonna go anywhere else?" I'm like, "Probably Madrid." Oh, can we go to Madrid? No, we're going to Dubai. Anyway, sorry, carry on. You were saying.
No, I understand. Yeah, listen, the team that I support in Paraguay, Cerro Porteño, that was the team that my dad supported. Mm. You know, it's the team of majority of my family. So it kind of is the same thing. And, you know, I think as well for myself, having an immigrant parent who comes to the United States that wants to give their son the best life possible, you know, they also don't want to forget about the roots where they come from. And obviously being that football is giants in Paraguay, and of course in the United States it would eventually, since the day I was born, or at least, you know, since the growth of the sport ever since the 90s, you know, it was always a part of my life, and eventually I think it would play a place for me to do something. You know, I played, and, you know, I wanted to, you know, do something, but, you know, I wasn't the best player, I'll admit, but I think going back and looking at these old games and watching it and being as an enthusiast, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I want to be a part of this. I want to have some sort of involvement with the sport. You know, maybe I won't be a good player that is able to make millions of dollars playing on the biggest teams like a lot of these kids are, but, you know, I still want to be involved somewhere. And, you know, I think if I have to write a book on my life, or just like if someone would ask me, you know, how did you get involved in this and why did you want to get involved in this industry? You know, I probably would have to go back to that summer in 2010 where it would all start, and kind of everything after that just put me on that understanding of why I wanted to be involved in the sport in the first place.
Great stuff, mate. Brilliant. Okay, next game. Well, same year, 2010, Barcelona 5, Real Madrid 0. The famous game where Gerard Piqué had five fingers in the air. Spoke about this with Ray Power the other day. And again, I'm going to say to you exactly what I said to him. Real Madrid played a ridiculously high line, but Barcelona carved them up. It's almost as if it was a hot knife through butter, mate.
Yeah, honestly. And I think when it comes to, you know, it's kind of also the understanding that for me on a personal level, I've always enjoyed international football. I don't know why people would go against it. I mean, everyone has their own opinions and whatnot. But I think for me, because I was introduced to it first before club football, I will always have this appreciation. But of course, when it comes to club football, I think when this game is demonstrated, because it really was Guardiola's side at its best, you know, that side that would have, you know, they didn't win the treble that year, but you know, they would formidably dominate La Liga and do well and obviously win the Champions League over there at Wembley in 2011. So yeah, I think that game was so memorable because it was seeing those players that were obviously, you know, coming off as well as world champions, you know, your Xavis, your Pedros, your Villas, your Gerard Piqué's, Victor Valdez's, and so Busquets and so on and so forth. That team really just demonstrated how dominant and how great they play football. I mean, you know, I think that time as well, you know, the Guardiola-Mourinho rivalry that started for a couple of years and just got really heated when it comes to it. It's just, for me, going back, I think it's a great game to really understand how special that derby is. And we look at the goal scorers as well. We have Xavi, Pedro, Villa, Brace. But, you know, we forget the last guy, Jeffrin, the guy who right now is playing in Croatia at the moment. And
yep.
I actually didn't know this at the time. He's actually Venezuelan. I didn't know that until I saw a game. And I saw his name. And I was thinking, wait, is that the same Jeffrin that scored against Real Madrid?
Well, that's him. And the funny thing is, when we were discussing on the show, I had my friend Mike on the show, and he goes to me, I bet he played in Cyprus, because he did. So he had a bit of a spell in Cyprus as well, which is ridiculous, because that's where a lot of people tend to go when they're in the back end of their careers. But he was 26, 27 when he went out there, I think. So,
I think it's also, it was difficult because, you know, I think that Barcelona side was so deep, and, you know, when you have so many players there that are undisputed starters, you know, that. Then you leave the likes of, you know, obviously Bojan, who, you know, was also this big promise, but never amounted to the amount of stardom that he was expected to go, you know, with him or Jeffrin or Alphalai, the Dutch midfielder. It was difficult because that team was just, it was so good with what they already had, and it was so consistent. I think it really was a really special team. I think, you know, and even if Ferguson, Sir Alex did say that, you know, that was the best squad he ever faced in that final, I think shows the respect that they had. And, you know, it was kind of bittersweet that they didn't win with the treble, because maybe that would have been able to demonstrate their greatness even better. But that team, and I think that game as well was special, because it really proved how great that this side was and how dominant that they would be. And of course, when the likes of a Lionel Messi comes up, when he was 23 at the time, and from there he was just unstoppable for many years. So yeah, that's a special game in my heart.
Absolutely. All right, and the final one, which took place at the Bernabeu, believe it or not. Blimey, now this one had everything you needed in terms of a build-up to a game. It was just like a soap opera. What do you expect from a derby game? River Plate beating Boca Juniors 3-1 in the second leg of the Copa Libertadores final, beating them 5-3 on aggregate. The star of the show was undoubtedly Quintero, who I've found him the most underrated player. I first heard of him back in 2012, And he had this spell at Porto, and I was like, right, this kid looks really good. And unfortunately, he hasn't had the best of careers, although he's probably better as a reggaeton artist than he is a footballer, to be fair. But yeah, as I said, a lot of controversy before this game, Rob. Do you want to enlighten our listeners or just remind them? Because I'm pretty sure they know about it. But
where to begin? Yeah, I guess we'll go back. So this happened on December 9th in 2018. The original first leg was supposed to happen 28 days before, on the 11th. It's funny too, because even though the game, at least when you look at it from a larger perspective, you know, this was going to be a special final because he has two teams, and also what was interesting that this was going to be the last Copa Libertadores final to be having on two legs, which has always been a tradition for South American teams ever since the creation of the tournament back in 1960. You know, to have both teams play home and away gave them that special feeling for them and kind of that uniqueness that you probably don't see in Europe or in North America or anywhere else. You know, to have both teams and seeing both sides of fans at their home stadiums, you know, and two memorable stadiums as well, with La Bombonera for Boca and then at the Monumental at River. So, yeah, this built up a lot of expectation, but also a lot of fear, because, as you know, these teams had already faced each other prior in Libertadores, and let's just say that they haven't been the most peaceful. I mean, if you can recall about 3 years ago when River won their first Copa Libertadores after 19 years, they faced Boca in the round of 16, and, you know, River were winning 1-0 in the first leg. And then the second leg happened, was still 0-0, still tight over there, La Bombonera, when the game was suspended because of an attack from a pepper spray from the Boca Juniors fans. And that led to that game being abandoned. Boca Juniors would get kicked out of the tournament and River would go on and win the title. So, yeah, there was a lot of kind of no love lost. And when you talk about two bitter rivals, I mean, come on, we can be fair that the Superclásico is maybe, in my opinion, the biggest derby in the world, with certain exceptions, obviously, but... You know, I for some reason knew that when this game was building up, even from the quarterfinals, even people in Argentina were thinking, no, this something is going to go wrong, something. And it turned out to be a complete shit fest. It was incredible. I mean, the first game that was supposed to happen on the 10th, it was delayed, it was postponed because it was raining, and that means that, you know, the Bombonera was waterlogged. It was because it was pouring, so they moved the game to the next day, and it was a dramatic game as well, a 2-2 draw that ended it. And then the second leg happens, where, you know, everything seemed to be normal. You know, everyone was thinking, and everything was set up to be a special game because, you know, it was tied. Nothing was decided yet. It was going to be at River Plate, you know, a World Cup stadium, and all that kind of stuff, when we see another pepper spray incident, this time broken by the River Plate fans to go to the Boca Juniors bus, essentially breaking the glass on the bus and allowed pepper spray to go in, which eventually led to the delays of the game to an hour, and then it moved 20 minutes later. It just kept going on and on. No one knew when this game was going to start. Until, you know, Conmebol made the decision to reschedule it and to postpone it. And then it was just, you know, this whole kind of beef and you know, dispute with, you know, River and Boca and Conmebol, even FIFA, with Gianni Infantino, who actually went to this game and obviously had a bad impression about it. You know, they didn't know what to do. They knew deep down that the safety concerns, at least what Boca Juniors had applied to, that they were not going to play this game under the conditions, because they knew that the safety of these fans was not guaranteed. Now, we have to remember, away fans have been banned in Argentina for quite some time because of an incident. So everything's already on edge, where you don't see the few thousand Boca fans or the few thousand River fans away. You don't have those away days, unfortunately. So, you know, eventually something would eventually play out, and, you know, they would move the game to the Bernabeu, which... was probably ironic, because what the tournament was called was the Copa Libertadores. The Libertadores were the conquistadors of basically South America, you know, the so-called leaders of of South American wars of independence. Now,
against the Spanish.
It was against the Spanish. And to have the most prestigious club competition to be played in the so-called mother country gave a little bit of a weird spell and kind of a disgust to see what happened. But it went well eventually. You know, the 70,000 fans that hit to the Bernabeu is a funny story. Before I get to the game, I think there was a report, I think, made from a Spanish channel that game, because of the passionate fans that both sides had, one Spanish reporter, or at least a TV show, said that it was the first time that the Bernabeu ever saw passion in the state. So essentially, they're telling off that their Real Madrid fans are cold and everyone in Spain is cold. So it's like, you know, they saw a real environment, because you know how it is. Mm-hmm. So you've seen games in South America where they're cheering up and down for 90 minutes, even if Boca are down 2 or 3 nil or something, they're still going to be cheering as if they're winning 2 or 3 nil. It's just the passion that it has over there in the country. But onto the game, it was a special game as well. Benedetto scores right before halftime, gives him the famous tongue celebration, the River Plate fans. And it seemed as if it was tight end to end as well, which was entertaining and would prove that, you know, on equal standards, that this would be an entertaining fest. But of course, you know, River fought back. You know, Prato equalizes in the 68th minute with a great shot. Then the game goes into extra time, and that's when everything started to come and the pieces started to follow. William Barrios was sent off with 10 men, and then, you know, River take advantage. And then, of course, the Quintero goal. Like I said, I agree with you, man. I like seeing Quintero play. I hope that he does go back to Europe very, very soon. I mean, he's still quite young. He's 27, so he still can do something. But, man, that left-footed shot into the top corner past Andrada was... That was magnificent. It was a beautiful goal. And kind of assured River Plate the title in a way. Then the injury to Fernando Gago in the 116th minute, and you know, they couldn't use any more subs because they already used all four of them.
Yep.
So they had to basically play with 9 men. And then the famous empty net goal by PT Martinez, and yeah, that gave River Plate probably bragging rights for a long, long time, because, you know, even though Boca Juniors have more titles and, you know, they've obviously, at least in the Libertadores, you know, they have that bragging rights, but to win the so-called ultimate final, even now more than 2 years, almost 2 years to the day, you know, people will still think about it and say that the famous "you died in Madrid" to the Boca fans. Yeah, that bragging rights will guarantee them for their neighbors for many years to come, and maybe until the next Copa Libertadores finals being played in, I don't know. We gotta put a heat. if there's ever gonna be a final that's gonna surpass this, it has to be played in a really intense environment, more intense than the Bernabeu. I mean, Stel, is there a stadium in Cyprus that might be available for a game like this?
Cyprus, no, but in Greece, definitely. The Dumba, also known as the Tomb, Paok Stadium. It's immense. It's got a running track, but I don't know if I've shown you the video of the title celebrations when they won the league a couple seasons ago. The whole stadium, it looked like it was on fire.
Yeah, that's the thing too. What sucks is that final, the you know, as you know, Libertadores finals, you know, they could use flares and whatnot, but, you know, we didn't see that in the Bernabeu. But can you just imagine if it was just like heated in that sense, where it's like full of smoke for the Libertadores title?
But things, I heard that both sets of fans only had 5,000 tickets.
Yeah, that's right, and you know, it's expensive to go to Spain as well, and let's be real, these Argentine fans will sell anything to go and support their team, be it in Madrid or in Japan or anywhere in the world. They will go wherever they go. And given the state of the country as well, it just shows how crazy they've been. And yeah, it kind of, even though you could hear the fans and that kind of thing, and you see both sets of fans, it could have been much better. Maybe it's just me expecting too much, because, you know, you see them at the Moneda or the Monumental and stuff like that. You would expect a better atmosphere. But Yeah, I think if there were more fans, where it's, I don't know how much the Bernabeu is, like, what, 80,000 or something? So,
yeah.
Yeah, you put 40,000 in Boca and 40,000 in the River, then you have a show. Then you have a real show right there. So, but yeah, I guess financial costs and demands are just too much for even the Argentines to even play their way out, because you know how it is when the so-called, what's it called? The supporter groups, the Barra Bravas, have their way even to go to these games. So yeah. Even then, they can't find it to Florentino Perez's money.
Well, see, this is the thing, right? Tim Vickery always says that the South American leagues, like your Brazilian leagues, your Argentinian leagues, they missed the boat when it came to promoting their product in the Far East. So obviously, the UK got in there first and whatnot, and they could have built on that. They could have been far better positioned financially had they done it themselves. Now, do you think this game kind of set a precedent in the sense that, well, CONMEBOL, it's CONMEBOL, isn't it?
Yeah, CONMEBOL.
They could turn and say, well, okay, well, maybe two or three times a season we'll go to Europe and play games. That won't sit well with the fans, will it?
No, and also I think what we see the following year, in Lima, when Flamengo take on River, you know, the first ever game. And let's be real, that game was also, in traditional South American fashion, that game was supposed to happen in a city, and it didn't. It was supposed to happen in Santiago at the national stadium. Got moved to Lima, just literally, I think, a week or so until the actual game. They weren't going to postpone it because they didn't want a Bernabeu 2.0. So, and then, you know, given that, I think the game was shown in England as well. It was shown all around the world, this game. So when you see that product and obviously the fashion that it would end up being, you know, Gabigol's two goals in the last few minutes of the game, I think proved that, you know, maybe this kind of neutral final will work out. You know, I mean, we saw that in the Bernabeu, maybe not in the best perspectives, but, you know, we saw it in Lima the following year. And of course, with this eventual hopeful final, if it ever happens, it was supposed to happen at the Maracana in November, but it won't be the same if there's no fans, obviously. But I don't think it will sit well as well, maybe from a marketing standpoint. I mean, we already see rumors of how they want Champions League finals, UEFA Champions League finals, played in the States or in China or something like that. So the demand is always there. But I think in just South America, who, let's be real, they absolutely want the money. They need the money because of the recession and obviously the disadvantages that they have in comparison to their counterparts across the pond. They would like that. But I think it's just it takes out the mystique that it has. And with a tournament like this, they thought what we saw in the Bernabeu, even though it was a success from a football and collective standpoint, I think they realized that, no, we don't want, I think that was a one-off. We don't want this to happen again. And we need to understand that we need the best safety precautions needed if we're going to do this the right way, to do what they do in Europe with the Champions League and doing a neutral final. Mm-hmm. And that hopefully it could work out in the future.
Mm. Fair enough. Well, mate, one more thing before I let you go. I heard a little rumor that there's a possibility the MLS and the Mexican League may merge. Is that feasible? I mean, from a financial perspective.
Oh, it's a win-win, 100%. But I don't know how that. I mean, you already see the likes of a Super League in Europe anyway. You know, you have that kind of rumors as well. I just think there are just so many things that both leagues are so different. I mean, let's be real. Mexico is better than MLS, and they've demonstrated that by always winning the CONCACAF Champions Leagues and always beating the MLS teams for years. But I just don't think it's the best for both parties, because there's a different aspect to it. Let's be real. Mexico has had tradition for years, decades, different generations. Mm. MLS is only 24 years old. You know, it's still a baby in terms of comparing it to the other leagues across the region. So yeah, there might be a financial standpoint, but and mind you, MLS is full already. There's 30 teams, and there's no, 26 teams, but there's going to have more teams in the future. It's going to be almost 30 teams, and you know, there's no relegation. You know, and obviously, I can go on and off about the problems that American soccer has, especially in the MLS. But you know, they have to deal with it organically, and they can't. I don't know how it's going to be feasible to work this out, especially given that, let's be real, when you take out the United States and Mexico, who else is out there that is a force in CONCACAF? You know, maybe Costa Rica, maybe. I mean, after that, it's no one else. It's always been the United States and Mexico, and you know, that's an attribute to their financial advantages that they have, not on a sporting level, but from a country level. But I just, it doesn't work out properly because there's just so many teams, and you're breaking into two different cultures. Yeah, it's not a good idea in my book. Maybe from a financial standpoint, who knows? Yeah, this does not seem like a good idea, and I think both teams have to act independently on their own and grow organically as well.
Top stuff, mate. Brilliant. Wonderful. Right, cheers for joining me, mate. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we could do this again sometime.
100%, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. Well, look, before I let you go, all the socials, plug whatever you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can always follow me on Roberto Rojas 97 at Twitter. You know, obviously the podcast that you had mentioned at the beginning of the show is Low Limit Football. We are starting to get back into the swing of things, getting guests, talking about some sort of football that's happening, you know, but the Bundesliga is starting. Hopefully it will be for the long term at least. and yeah, you know, just follow me there. I'm doing all this stuff for being sports and many other things, and yeah, just that's it. I feel so boring about this, but listen, Stel, you know how it is sometimes. For you would prefer the boring people than the ones that are trying to act all extra and forced and whatnot, so yeah. you know what I'm talking about, my friend.
I prefer not to speak. Do you know what? I'm tired of biting my tongue. You know, it's become quite tedious. But at the same time, you know, sometimes you just got to be a little bit diplomatic. However, I'm telling you this from now. In the next few weeks, you might see a little bit of a change in our format. I say might, but
I'm excited for that.
We'll see. Well, look, that was Roberto Rojas, ladies and gentlemen. He's got a wonderful podcast. It's absolutely brilliant. I tune in every time they record it, and I've been on it a few times actually. I've got my hat trick ball actually. I still haven't had it signed from these lads,
We need to do that. We need to give you a. We definitely have to do that now. You mentioned it.
A hat trick ball, have it signed.
No, yeah. I think you need two of them because you've been on it more. So we need to give you. Let's be real, man. You'll. Stat pad more football appearances than anyone at this point.
So oh, cheers, mate.
We definitely have to do that.
Wonderful. Excellent. Right, guys, that's it from us. We have a Twitter handle at Shoot Defense. We are also on Instagram. So until next time, adios.